Taxation number 232320, Wheel 3.
Mr. Taylor, Rail 3, we're talking about your time aboard HMS Byron from 1943 right through to 1945. And in October, before the collision with the Tannatside, you joined the 21st Escort Group. Were
That's
you aware
right.
that you were part of that escort group?
Oh, yes, we were a hunter-killer group. In other words, we weren't escorting convoys. We were going looking for submarines.
What did that
U-boats.
Involve? For you, you know, as a working method.
Well, we used to do patrols on the likely spots where, you know, we thought U-boats would be, or we knew U-boats were there because of HFDF.
What was HFDF?
High frequency direction finders. In other words, we could, if the U-boat sent signals, we could pick up those signals, get a bearing on it, and establish where the submarine was, where it was coming from. I'm not up with the technical details, but I presume there was an HFDF ashore and an RHNDF, and where the two met, that's where the submarine is signalling from.
And
used to be called HFDF.
Do you remember any particular clashes with submarines from that time?
Supposed to have made a number of kills, but we never saw any submarines. We only saw stuff coming up. But I think the group were given credit for three submarines. I'm not quite sure.
Now, what about the arrival of your new first lieutenant? Because we've interviewed David Rapson quite.
Oh yes.
What was your first impression? Because it was quite lively his first night aboard ship. I think I don't know whether you remember that, but what first impression did you have of Rapson?
Well, my first impression was here was a typical RN officer.
So what do you mean by that?
Well, he was very straight. Obviously a disciplinarian. I think the first impression, I think he was about my age or perhaps a year older, but he'd had a very hard war, and he looked old and tired and all the rest of it. And so much so that it was after we paid off the Byron, I didn't see David Repard for about 50 years. And we had a reunion down on the south coast somewhere, and I kept saying to people, "Where's old David Repard? Where's old David Repard?" And David Repard had been there the whole time, but he looked younger then, 50 years later, than he did when I first met him on the Byron. Absolutely amazing. And even you've ever met him recently, he looks so well and young, doesn't he? Hey, and if you've seen him when he joined the Byron, he looked on death's door.
And did he make the ship more efficient?
Oh yes.
What sort of things did he do?
Oh, he tightened up on everything, and he wasn't afraid of putting his foot down, which I think sometimes RMVR officers, you know, when they're dealing with old salts, used to take an easy line. You know what I mean? But not with David. If it was wrong, it was wrong, and that was it. I admired him.
How did he get on with the captain, Southcombe? Was he all right?
Oh, Southcombe was marvellous. Lovely chap.
Now, there was a bit of a kerfuffle because Southcombe was taken off with appendicitis.
That is right.
Do you remember much about that?
Yes, I do.
That was the 6th of November, I think.
That's right.
44.
Yes. Southcombe was taken ill, and the group had a doctor. I forget which ship it was on. Anyway, it was on one of the other ships. And we sent the whaler over with the midshipman to pick him up. And I don't know what happened, but somehow the doc got in the drink. And we were detached, and we hastened back to get Lieutenant Southcombe aboard for an operation. But he didn't have an operation on board, although the doctor came over.
He didn't rejoin the ship at that stage, then?
No, no. We had a new captain, Captain Burfield.
What was he like?
He was very much, again, if, let me put it this way, I would have accepted Southcombe as an RMVR officer. He was so nice and pleasant and all the rest of it, whereas the RN types were different. They were, you know, it was a job to them, and, you know, it's a career, and they did what was right, and they weren't afraid of doing it. And Burfield was very much the same. He was a disciplinarian. He didn't mix with the other officers as Southcombe had done. You know, he only came down, you know, he'd send a message down, he'd come down for dinner, but not, you know, seldom.
What was the ship's morale like? What would you say that the ship was, you know, were they a good crew and did they have a good morale?
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, yes, there was no... after we got got back to Canteen Messingham, we didn't have any problems there.
Now, well, anything else you remember about this period, you know, January, February, March? You were on a constant stream of sort of anti-submarine patrols.
Yes, that's right. You know, we had contacts, and we were, you know, as I say, we were credited with the three subs, but we never saw any real action, really, apart from dropping depth charges and stuff coming up, you know.
Now, on the 8th of April, you were credited with sinking U-1001, I think it is. Do you recall that? That was using the Hedgehog.
Yes, I do remember that, yes.
What do you remember of that?
Well, I remember you attacking with the Hedgehog.
Can you explain to him what the Hedgehog was? Because a lot of people won't know.
Yes, well, you know what depth charges are. You chuck them overboard and they explode and all that. But to drop depth charges, you had to be doing a certain speed, otherwise you'd blow your stern up. And the idea was that at this speed, it was very difficult to judge the movements of the U-boat. But if you could go slowly, you could track them far more easily. And so that and the Hedgehog, instead of dropping the things, you fired them ahead. So that you could fire them ahead. And they weren't as big as depth charges, but there are more of them. They're more like mortars, and they shot off in a pattern so that they filled a large circle, and you had more chance of hitting the submarine using a Hedgehog than you have with depth charges, because you could stalk the thing and get it just right. So that was...
And that's what happened.
That's what happened, yes.
This is one of the ones where you just got debris. You didn't actually...
No, we never saw a submarine until later when they surrendered.
Now, we're sort of coming on to that. Well, how did the end of the war come about for you and your ship? I mean,
well, we at the end of the war, when the war finished, the German Navy or all the submarines were told to surface and rendezvous at certain spots and to fly a black flag. And Byron was allocated to one of these positions for the U-boats to surrender.
Where was that? Wait.
Oh, I'm very, very vague. It was somewhere off the west coast of Scotland somewhere. I just don't remember exactly where.
So what exactly happened? What do you remember of the surrender? Because it must have been quite a moment for you.
Oh, yes, I remember it. We got there and there's a submarine waiting for us. And I was in charge of the boarding party, and we went aboard.
Now, tell me exactly what you did as a boarding party.
Well, the first thing we did was to... We had a chain with us.
Well, hang on. How many of them were you, and how did you get there? Right from the start.
We took the motorboat, went alongside, and I think there were probably about five of us, or four or five. And the first thing we did was to make for the conning tower, and we had a chain with us, and we secured the chain on deck and dropped it down the hatch for the conning tower so that they couldn't close the hatch and submerge with us on the top. But it was all very sort of informal. There was no sort of animosity at all, not on my part. And certainly the German crew were quite passive and not bolshy, and it was all, you know, it wasn't exciting at all, really. It was just sort of, yeah, we're here to...
Did you look around the submarine when you were
aboard? Oh, yes, yes.
What were your impressions?
Well, the impressions was I'd hate to be a submariner, because the place stank of diesel, and very little space on the thing. But having said that, their rations were beautiful. You know, they had lots of delicacies and lots of hooch and all the rest of it. And I think, actually, as far as I remember, I think somebody led us into Loch Eriball. I don't remember sort of. I know we were behind, coming astern of the submarine, and there's one instance which I do remember. And what happened was that it was daylight, and myself and the petty officer were on the bridge, but on the conning tower, and I think we were following somebody else to Loch Eriball, and it was a perfectly lovely day, and the PO had what they called a Lanchester, which was rather like a deluxe Sten gun, and he plonked this down, butt down on the deck, and I don't know how it happened, but a round went off. And the German crews had these grey, they weren't leather, but they were grey sort of imitation leather jackets. And this bullet went right through his sleeve. And he never turned a bloody hair. He never turned a hair. Absolutely amazing. And... I forget, I'm a bit hazy. I remember the first one we took in, but I know we took others in, and I know that for about 3 days I didn't get any sleep. And when I got back on board, I slept for 24 hours.
What happened to you? You were escorting them into...
Loch Eriball.
Loch?
Eriball.
How do you spell that, sorry?
E-R-I-B-O-L-L.
And what happened then? When you took them in, what happened to the crew and the boat?
Oh, they were taken ashore. This was a prisoner of war. And the party came from the shore base and took over the submarine. And I rejoined the Baron, which is that one. You've seen that before. And
it's quite a famous picture of the first one coming in.
Yes, that was the first one to come into British port. That's right. 1009, I think it was. Yes, 1009.
Now, what happened after that, then? What's the next thing you recall?
I think I rejoined my ship and we went back to the same place and did some more submarines.
But after the submarine, that after that?
Well, when that was over, I think we just went back to the States.
Do you remember the journey back?
Yes. Well, no, it was uneventful, but what I was wondering, you know, how you've taken back the ship to hand it to the Americans, how careful they would be about everything being where it should be and all the rest of it. But well, they weren't in the least worried. They just sort of, okay, fine, you know, we'll take over now and that's it. And I think all the binoculars disappeared. You know.
And what happened to you then? What was your next commission? Just give us a review of the rest of your...
Yes. I had two ships after that. I'm not quite sure in what order they were, but one of them was an LST, and I think it was 3525. And
3525.
3525. And after the when the war was over, of course, they had a lot of assault craft, landing craft, and all the rest of it, and they didn't know what to do with them, I don't think, and they decided that what they'd do, they'd take them all up to one of the locks in Scotland and leave them there. And the LST we were on, we had the job, and there were only two officers, the skipper and myself, so we were watch and watch, and what we did was go along to where these assault craft were, and we got a cable from the capstan on the forecastle right back to the bridge, down below, and then into the hold, and we filled the ballast tank so the bow was as deep as possible, we could get it into the water, and then we'd hook these things on and pull them up, and to get them sliding on the deck we had to use grease, and we used to pull them up. I forget how many we got on. We got on quite a few of these things, and when we were full, we brought the bows up again and went up to Loch Fyne, I think, and there we were on CNM as a care and maintenance party. And then another ship I was on was, you won't believe this, the Princess Iris.
It's a picture of Princess Iris. And what exactly was the Princess Iris?
Well, I don't know what its function was during the war, but before the war, it was they used to get carriages, railway carriages on here and take them across to France and then take them off and put them, and I think they're gauges. And you know, I never know to this day what she did, and I honestly can't remember what I did there, but I was the only RNVR officer on board. All the rest were RNR, and there were millions of them. I think on these things, you know, where we'd have a chief stoker, they had an officer. And the captain, he must have thought he was still in the Merchant Navy, because all this naval drill, and I have the honour to be, sir, your obedient servant, he was completely knackered, and he used to leave it all to me. He was a nice chap, but to this day I don't know what we did. But that's it.
And then what happened after that?
Well, after that, in the meantime, of course, after the war, I volunteered for MVOL. MVOL.
What's that?
Well, volunteer to stay on in the Navy. And I volunteered to stay on. But after about 2 years, I got so fed up with the Navy routine. And give you an example of this, with old Burfield, we were at sea when the war was over, and when the end of the war was declared, he sent me from the bridge and told me to put a collar and tie on.
So you didn't like the peacetime?
I didn't like the peacetime routine. It was boring and it was bit and polished and all that. But at the same time, I'd had 7 years in the Navy, and facing Silly Street was a bit of a, you know, do I really want to go? And then I heard that the Control Commission for Germany were looking for naval types to run their customs and excise service. So I joined the Control Commission on the seaside, and I had a sort of motor launch, what do you call them, with the German crew, and I used to sort of pot around the coast and stop ships. And
whereabouts were you based?
In Cuxhaven.
Anything happened? Any points of interest?
Not that I can tell you. No.
Was there much smuggling or customs and excise?
Well, not really. One of the main things we were doing was trying to sort of catch Nazis who were trying to get out of the country. And we caught a couple in sailing boats trying to come up the Elbe, and we caught two of them and brought them ashore and all that. And I remember one other job we had was, it's just very, very vague, but a lot of ships were coming in with German Jews to go back to Germany. And we at Cuxhaven, we escorted them up to Hamburg. I don't know why.
Was that your last naval?
Oh, I was out in Germany for about 2 years, yes.
Till when?
Till 1949. I met my wife out there, and we got married out there, and that's it.
So you were there from 47 through to 49?
That's right, yes.
What about your demobilisation? What do you remember of that? or leaving the Navy?
Oh, dear. Well, I was... I was demobbed before I joined the CCG, but when the job finished in Germany, I had to start looking for a job in Civil Street.
And what did you select? Was your family business still going?
No, it was bombed during the war. My father had died, and my mother died when I was young, but I had an uncle in London who had a chemist shop. And he had two shops, actually. And I lived above the second shop with my wife until we found a house in Wimbledon. And I got a job with Samuel Jones. It doesn't ring a bell to you because they don't exist now. But a very big paper company who were taken over by Wigan Steep. And I was with them from 1949 till 1986.
So it was a paper supply company?
Paper supply company, yes. Mm.
And so that settled you back into civilian life?
That settled me back into civilian life.
How do you think your naval experiences and services affected you mentally and physically, good or bad? I mean, do you think it did?
Oh, I'll be honest with you, I enjoyed my time in the Navy. And my wartime time in the Navy, but not the peacetime.
Had it done you any good or bad? Any damage or good?
No, I don't think so. I think it was an experience. And on the other hand, of course, if the war hadn't have happened, I might have been probably better off than I am now, but I will.